him out about two more lockdown gatherings at the Downing Street, including one at Johnson's own flat. A probe is now underway into whether the parties broke COVID rules. The Premier is facing calls to step down.
Downing Street willfully broke the rules and mocked the sacrifices we have all made, shattering the public's trust. The Prime Minister has a duty, the only right and moral choice left to him. It is for his resignation.
Yeah. Labour leader Keir Starmer is strongly critical of Johnson too.
But there's also this basic question of trust, and that is broken with the Prime Minister. Okay. And that's why he is unfit for office.
In recent months, the British Prime Minister has faced criticism over other issues, including his handling of a sleaze scandal, the awarding of lucrative COVID contracts, and the refurbishment of his Downing Street flat. That's beside revelations Johnson intervened to evacuate pets from Kabul during the chaotic Afghan withdrawal in August. Now the latest scandal involving the lockdown parties may be the final nail in the coffin as Johnson's popularity continues to plummet. More than half of those taking part in the latest opinion poll believe that the Premier should step down.
Iran's lead negotiator at the Vienna talks aimed at reviving the Joint Comprehensive Plan of Action, the JCPOA, says his team has not yet received any proposal or initiative from the other side to help resolve the outstanding issues.
Both on the issue of sanctions removal and nuclear measures, there have been disagreements. These are clearly visible in the draft that was achieved following the previous round of talks. The disagreements, especially on the nuclear issue, are numerous and varied. On these disagreements, we have not yet received any proposal or initiative from the other side.
In the past days, questions have arisen about the drafts being discussed and whether the Iranian team's amendments and proposals, offered in the form of two written drafts at the beginning of the seventh round, are still on the table.
Over the past few days, we have had various meetings at the levels of experts and senior political directors, during which the modifications, viewpoints and proposals of the Iranian side on the June 20th draft were discussed, and these discussions were positive and moving forward.
Iran says it would only go back to full compliance after the full and verifiable removal of U.S. sanctions. And while some sources say the Iranian demands are stalling progress, others like Russia's lead delegate maintain the atmosphere is positive amid intensive dialogue.
The important thing for Iran is that the current negotiations move forward and that all of the sanctions, the maximum pressure sanctions, are removed and there's a verification process. And Iran really has to be compensated for all the damage that Western countries have done to the people of Iran.
On Sunday, a third working group focusing on the sequencing of compliance by all parties was held for the first time during the seventh round of talks. That was followed by a trilateral meeting between Iran, Russia and China. There's been no official word yet about the duration of the current round of talks. Homolesky, Vienna.
The tragedies caused by the Saudi-led war on Yemen are going beyond the casualties of airstrikes and an ongoing blockade. The Yemeni Pediatric Society says the number of infants with birth defects has increased rapidly since the 2015 war that turned Yemen into a testing ground for internationally banned weapons.
The weapons used by the Saudi-led coalition against our country contain prohibited chemicals that directly affect pregnant women and fetuses. That has increased the birth rate of children with cancer and congenital anomalies, especially in the areas that are being continuously bombed, such as Sana'a, Hodeida, Hajja, and Sada.
Officials say chemical and biological bombs dropped from Saudi warplanes on Yemenis have made Yemen the world's worst epidemic disaster. They're calling for an investigation into recent cases of congenital anomalies.
Since the first day of the aggression, the Saudi-led coalition has used various types of prohibited weapons, including cluster and phosphorus bombs, to target residential and agricultural areas. As a result of environmental contamination, we witnessed a dramatic rise of congenital malformations amongst children. We demand the documentation of the pathological cases caused by these bombs to reveal Saudi Arabia's war crimes.
Infants are suffering difficult conditions in Yemen in the absence of essential medical supplies and healthcare facilities needed for their survival and well-being. Yemeni health centers have been in a dire situation since the start of the Saudi-led war.
As the war goes on, Yemeni children continue to be at the brunt of the death and destruction left behind by Saudi-banned weapons. People here believe that Riyadh has always been violating international law by using cluster munitions in bombing residential areas since it started its deadly war on Yemen. Abdul Latif Al-Washali, Sana'a.
The U.S. is stunned by a devastating storm of tornadoes that ripped through the six states of Arkansas, Illinois, Kentucky, Missouri, Mississippi, as well as Tennessee overnight. Strong thunderstorms triggered dozens of tornadoes that crumbled metal like paper, swatted down concrete buildings, and threw a freight train off its track. Among notable casualties are a candle-making factory in Kentucky, a nursing home in Arkansas, and an Amazon warehouse in Illinois. An Illinois resident explains how he was shocked by the extent of damage after he rushed to his mother's house.
The damage is worse than some of the stuff I've seen in war pictures, so it's pretty intense. You know, it's not anything that I thought when she called me and told me that, oh, all my trees are gone. I was like, I got here and I did not expect to see this.
The town of Mayfield in Kentucky was described as ground zero by officials and appeared post-apocalyptic. A restaurant owner says the town's residents have lost it all.
It was just, this is our hometown, and it's just devastating. Everybody's lost everything.
Rescue workers across the middle of the country are combing through wreckage for survivors. Scores of deaths have already been confirmed, and officials warn that the toll is almost certain to rise as they are sifting through the ruins for the missing. President Joe Biden is going to travel to areas affected by what he has described as likely one of the largest tornado outbreaks in the American history.
I'm monitoring the situation very closely since early this morning. This is likely to be one of the largest tornado outbreaks in our history. It's a tragedy. It's a tragedy.
President Biden also said he would task the environmental agencies to take a look at the specific impact climate change might have had on the deadly tornadoes. A meteorologist says he has rarely seen anything like this tornado storm during his career, spanning four decades.
I was watching the radar last night, and I was saying, wait a second, this is December. How is this happening in December? This is the kind of thing you would only see at the height of the season, you know, March, April, May. I'd never seen anything like this this time of year. I mean, and you hardly ever see something like this in a career.
The tornadoes have left a trail stretching around 370 kilometers. The multi-state disaster has freshened debates about whether climate change had a role to play in triggering these tornadoes, which are believed to be quite unseasonal, and whether a warmer planet would mean the world should expect to see more disasters of the kind.
Afghans said the Taliban takeover of the country has not brought an end to terrorist attacks there. In addition to three large mosque blasts, recently IED bomb attacks have been continuously taking lives in the capital, Kabul. People say they're worried about such time-to-time bomb attacks, most of which carried out by Daesh.
People thought that bomb attacks will come to an end after the Taliban takeover, but we still do not feel safe. We live in the west of Kabul. Here, we witness explosions every week. We ask the Islamic Emirate to take the security seriously.
Yesterday, an explosion hit a civilian vehicle here. Many were killed and wounded. Recently, people have been fearful of roadside and IED bomb attacks. The terrorists place bombs inside buses and everywhere. so people don't dare to take a bus or walk safely.
But Taliban officials have stressed that there is no place for Daesh or other terrorist groups in Afghanistan.
There is no active or observable terrorist group in Afghanistan. The Islamic Emirate has strong control over Afghanistan. No group or individual dares to stand against the Islamic Emirate or threaten the nation. However, there have been sporadic movements under the name of Daesh to create terror, but our forces are following them and will dismantle them soon.
The waves of terror attacks come as the Afghan society is struggling with unemployment, poverty and hunger. People say they're disappointed being hit by all these catastrophes. On Friday, here in western Kabul, two explosions hit civilian targets, killing two and injuring at least four. The attacks were claimed by Daesh terrorist group. The continuation of such incidents is raising concerns among the people. Rahmatullah Baghban, Kabul.
It was only last month when the statements by Lebanon's then Information Minister George Kordahi made headlines. In a televised interview recorded in August, before his appointment as a minister, Kordahi said the war in Yemen was futile and that Saudi Arabia and the UAE were the aggressors in that conflict. But it didn't take long for him to become the target of an unprecedented pressure campaign conducted by Saudi Arabia and its allies. In a bid to ease the tensions, Kordahi decided to leave office, a move he says he did not feel good about in the first place.
When I resigned, I did not feel good about being forced to step down. If Lebanon did not have these current problems and crisis and bankruptcy, I would have no reason to resign. And the government could have opposed my resignation and the whole Lebanese nation would have rejected it. For 40 days, I was under pressure from all sides, forcing me to resign. I resisted for 40 days. I could have resisted for 40 years, but I needed to consider the national interests.
Kordahi says he resigned to put the interest of Lebanese people first, but he says he's surprised at the extent of the influence external players exerted to make him step down.
We have hardly ever seen a government demanding the resignation of a minister or an official in another country, or setting it as a condition where a country has no choice but to comply. This has not happened, but in Lebanon, it is the second time that such a thing is happening. I have not disrespected anyone. 2 months before a ministerial appointment, I said something that was in favor of all parties without hurting anyone. Now I feel I have been oppressed.
The former Lebanese minister says his resignation has been a bargaining chip. The French President Emmanuel Macron has used to open talks with Saudi Crown Prince Mohammed bin Salman. Throughout the whole interview, Kordahi stresses his firm stance on his previously stated views.
I have borne the cost of my position on the Lebanese resistance and Syria throughout the past 10 years. Today, I also paid the price of my position on Yemen, and I am proud of it. Each media activist is the voice of the people and should not hide the truth.
And when asked if he would retract the statements triggering his forced resignation, he says he would not back down.
I will repeat the same remarks, because I spoke in good faith and did not say anything to offend anyone. This war, the war in Yemen, is an erosive war for both of these countries and all aggressors. Therefore, I demand an end to this year's long war.
Kordahi resigned for criticizing years of devastating war, a war that has taken the lives of hundreds of thousands of Yemeni people, displacing millions and creating a dire situation that is described by the United Nations as the world's worst humanitarian crisis.
The death of India's Chief of Defence Staff, Bipin Rawat, his wife and 11 others in a chopper crash on Wednesday made big news across the subcontinent. The report went viral on social media and received huge attention region-wide. Following the incident, a female staffer at one of the Kashmir's leading banks received suspension for what they described as, quote, inappropriate reaction to a social media post about the death of the chief of defense staff, unquote. People in Kashmir are criticizing the suspension, saying this is a violation of their rights to free speech.
Jo social media hai.
I am not judging her reaction, but emoji symbols are sometimes sent by mistake since touch screens are highly sensitive. This is highly undemocratic on the part of Kashmir officials.
In the Indian-administered Kashmir, government offices and semi-government institutions have issued circulars and updated codes of conduct cautioning employees against posting anything critical of India or its rule in the region. Scores of people in Kashmir have removed their social media posts out of fear of police action. A police officer who didn't want his name to be disclosed said that only posts that can attract a lot of attention or encourage disruption of public order are being assessed, since Kashmir is a sensitive region. However, analysts say authorities in Kashmir are trying to control the narrative to justify India's decision to end Kashmir's special status in August 2019.
This is depiction or reflection of sense of insecurity which has overtaken Indian state, because they feel if they allow people to express freely, the reality of Kashmir will get exposed before whole of the world.
India is increasingly using its anti-terror laws since the Hindu nationalist party Bharatiya Janata Party came to power in 2014. In Kashmir alone, over 2,300 people have been booked under the law since 2019, and half of them are still in prison. Global human rights bodies, including the United Nations, slammed India last month for arresting Kashmir's human rights activist Khurram Parvez under its anti-terror law. India has dismissed the UN charges as baseless, but people and analysts say repressive techniques are being used to suppress dissent in Kashmir. Shahanabad, Indian-administered Kashmir.
Hi, good morning.
Hello, good morning.
Good morning.
Morning, sir.
Half a kilo of halim, please.
Hi, sir.
Hi, kitty. Good morning.
Number one, hands up. Number two, hands on the waist.
Hi, good morning.
Hi, good morning.
Get ready for jogging to warm up.
Hello, good morning.
Hello, good morning.
One loaf of well-baked bread, please.
Supplication on Thursdays. In the name of Allah, the All-Merciful, the All-Compassionate. Praise belongs to Allah, who has taken away the shadowy night by His power and brought the sight-giving day through His mercy. He has clothed me in its brightness and given me its favor. O Allah, just as Thou hast spared me for this day, so also spare me for its likes. Bless the Prophet Muhammad and his household, and torment me not in it. and in other nights and days by allowing me to commit unlawful acts and to clothe myself in sins. Provide me with its good, the good of all within it, and the good of everything after it, and turn away from me its evil, the evil of all within it, and the evil of everything after it. O Allah, by the protective compact of Islam, I seek mediation with Thee, and by the inviolability of the Quran, I rely upon Thee. By Muhammad, the Chosen, Allah bless him and his household, I seek intercession with Thee. So recognize my protective compact, by which I hope my need will be granted. O most merciful of the merciful, O Allah, decree for me on Thursday five things, which none embraces but Thy generosity, and none supports but Thy favors. Health through which I may have the strength to obey Thee. Worship by which I may deserve Thy plentiful reward. Plenty in my state through lawful provision. And that Thou makest me secure in the places of fear through Thy security. And placest me in Thy fortress against the striking of worries and sorrows. Bless Muhammad and his household. And make my seeking his mediation as an intercessor give profits on the day of resurrection. Surely, Thou art the most merciful of the merciful.
Us out from Ontario, Canada.
Now back to our story.
What is it in there?
We will be talking about this.
Let me bring in Leo Sazdi. He's a professor of international.
The Spotlight.
According to New York Times and several other news outlets, Washington has decided against punishing any members of the U.S. military involved in an August drone attack in the Afghan capital. 10 civilians, including 7 children, were killed in that attack. An internal Pentagon review has concluded that a bombing in Kabul did not violate the laws of war and was not caused by misconduct or criminal negligence. The U.S. military defended the bombing, insisting that it targeted terrorists who intended the attack U.S. soldiers.
August 30th, 2021. Grieving and baffled Afghans gather around the mangled vehicle inside a house in Kabul. An apparent explosion a day earlier had killed 10 fellow civilians, including 7 children. The sorrow and confusion, however, would gradually give way to fury and clarity as media reports and investigations emerged over the following days. Finally, some 20 days after the incident, the U.S. decided to come out with the truth, admitting that it had made a, quote, tragic mistake in targeting the civilians. This came after initially defending their strike as righteous and insisting that it struck a Daesh vehicle carrying explosive to blow up Hamid Karzai International Airport. The strike came in the final days of the U.S.-led evacuation of Kabul after the Taliban takeover of Afghanistan. There was widespread condemnation of the attack, with Iran saying the U.S. cannot exonerate itself by downplaying such atrocities as mistakes. Yet, as it now turns out, this is exactly what the U.S. has done, with the Pentagon saying that there will be no disciplinary action against any U.S. troops or officials. Pentagon spokesman John Kirby said Secretary of Defense Lloyd Austin had received a high-level review of the strike that made no recommendation of accountability.
None of their recommendations dealt specifically with issues of accountability. The Secretary reviewed their recommendations. I won't get into all of them. Some of them are understandably classified, but he approved their recommendations. So I do not anticipate there being issues of personal accountability to be had with respect to the August 29th airstrike.
This has further fueled criticism of the U.S., with the acknowledgement of the mistake standing in stunning contrast to its refusal to hold anyone accountable for any wrongdoing.
This is typical U.S. governance. There's no accountability. These are war crimes. There's no question about that. And yet the U.S., which admitted liability in this and is compensating the victim survivors, is not holding anyone accountable for this crime, the slaughter of 10 people, including several children. This is why the U.S. will not sign the Rome Statute and join the International Criminal Court, because it knows that it commits war crimes around the world. This one is just one of many. This crime has been committed. And the U.S. doesn't want to hold its soldiers accountable in any way, or doesn't want anyone else to hold them accountable.
Sadly, the Kabul drone strike against civilians was not a one-off incident. Just last month, a report revealed that the U.S. military had tried to cover up two back-to-back airstrikes against supposed Daesh targets that killed up to 64 women and children in Syria in 2019. In two decades of wars across the world, from Afghanistan through Iraq and Syria to Somalia, the U.S. military has killed hundreds, if not thousands, of civilians. And while the military occasionally accepts responsibility for an errant airstrike or a ground raid that harms civilians, rarely does it ever hold specific individuals accountable. Maybe that trend will change one day, when the U.S. itself is held accountable by the international community.
Welcome to the Spotlight. I'm your host, Behrouz Najafi. Allow me to introduce our guests in this edition. Radio host and journalist Don DeBar is joining us out of New York. And from Afghanistan Task Force of Schiller Institute, Carol Varekin, out of Paris' suburbs.
This is The Spotlight. The Spotlight takes an in-depth look at the headlines, featuring interviews with well-known guests from diverse backgrounds to get to the bottom of the story. You can listen to The Spotlight every day on IRIB English Radio.
Welcome to the show, both gentlemen. Now let's go to New York. Don, this is Pentagon, and it's not acknowledging, it did not acknowledge this deadly strike until a week after there was this Times Magazine investigation and there was video evidence challenging assertions by the military that it hit a vehicle carrying explosives meant for the Kabul International Airport. I want to ask you the reason behind this reluctance and reticence, if you will, on the part of the U.S. military, usually in such occasions and incidents?
Well, they're committing war crimes and genocide against thousands of victims, potentially millions of victims, on an ongoing basis for decades. They don't want the world to have a conversation about it, and they don't want the American people to realize that that's what their money is being spent on. And so the only people that are ever punished in these cases are the whistleblowers. For example, Julian Assange. For example, Manning. For example, John Kiriakou, etc. The people who expose these incidents end up being the ones that are prosecuted, and those that are responsible for them, from the President of the United States, who authorizes them, to the Joint Chiefs of Staff, and then to the military commanders, down to the person sitting in a closet somewhere in upstate New York who thinks they're playing a video game in terms of how much threat they're under, while people are being blown apart on the ground, including 7 children in this one of many, many incidents.
All right. Now, Carol, how do you look at this? Do you agree on the same view with Don?
Yes, but I think the point is to look to the chain of command. Armies as such always have difficulties to recognize their errors. But there was a lot of chaos on the ground, but also in Washington itself, among different factions, among the White House and the Pentagon. And some military probably were so frustrated and they felt something and they did doing anything. So the result was both incompetent and horrendous, including that the person they was targeted, Zamari Ahmadi, which was suspected to be a terrorist, in reality was a humanitarian worker working for a U.S. charity, trying to distribute water to people which needed it. So the reputation of the U.S. military is definitely at stake here, both internationally but also at home. And if the press hadn't done their job, the affair would probably have been ignored, as many others before.
Mm-hmm. Now, Don, as you know, the Pentagon chief has decided not to punish any U.S. troops for this Kabul attack that killed civilians, and they just suffice to call it a tragic mistake. Is that how human lives matter to Washington?
Well, it's not a mistake, because the very presence of U.S. troops in Afghanistan is a violation of international law. So any death that flows from that, whether justified under U.S. excuses or not, is an individual war crime. See, the problem is not that this one wasn't a terrorist and instead was a civilian. The United States annually, going back to at least 1945, kills more people every year than the entire collection of terrorists on the planet that year. Mm-hmm. Who's the terrorist?
Exactly, good question. Also, there is this bad terrorist and good terrorist. Okay. Now, Carol, the Pentagon says that the Kabul attack did not infringe on laws of war. Laws of war. What laws of war are they talking about? Killing women and children and shirking responsibility? Or is it calling peripheral damage? That's the word they use. You know, they say it's inevitable in any war.
Well, as you said before, normally, as was said before, normally there was a transition of power has been reflected on since the Doha agreements of February 2020. Mm-hmm. And some in Washington, they might have thought that this should become a bloodbath, a disaster they could then blame on somebody, on their opponents. So there was confusion on the stage, and which only was multiplying the dangers. Now, I think the only way to honestly repair this evil policy would be to immediately release the $9.5 billion of assets of the Afghan Central Bank. We don't need excuses and condolences. You know, we need a policy to rebuild this entire region by mutual win-win cooperation, not by... We can put somebody in jail and we should completely drop this lunatic so-called precision drone strikes, which is completely incompetent.
Mm-hmm. All right, Don, this seems to be common practice for the U.S., I mean, the way they did it, isn't it? I mean, drones or troops kill people in the course of operations against shadow enemies like Al-Qaeda or Daesh or ISIS. Civilians are killed, not only Afghanistan, we have the same cases in Iraq and Syria and Somalia. And the U.S. military, from time to time, they admit to errant strikes, and they rarely ever hold perpetrators accountable. Let's have your thoughts on that.
I mean, the mode that was used in this case publicly after this particular strike was exposed, and you're going to see a prosecution probably of whoever leaked it to the Times or whoever at some point. But the mode that they use tells all. Okay, the people that are involved in the incident, normally, if you're accused of committing murder, in essence, you know, an illegal killing, a felony, under the military code of justice, you're entitled to proceeding with what's called a court member panel, which is like a jury.
Right.
Okay, there's objective fact finders instead of, you know, the decision coming down from on high. That, when they said that they would not face trial, that meant that the outcome was not going to have those hands in it. It was going to be decided by a much more powerful and smaller set. So they kicked it into an administrative proceeding, essentially, where the determination is made by the people at the top. So when they decided that that's how it was going to happen, they already decided that either one possibility was they were going to use the operator as a scapegoat instead of holding the people responsible for putting that person at the controls of those weapons which were illegally used to murder someone. And instead they were going to decide, you know, who it would be, but not them. The actual responsibility in the chain of command goes to those at the top who made the policy decisions and then gave the orders to implement them that resulted in these deaths, which occurred by military action not authorized by the United Nations Security Council, which means it is illegal under international and U.S. law. And consequently, someone should be prosecuted for those murders. They decided instead that they would protect everyone involved from an actual legal proceeding that was transparent, because they conduct these things over and over, and mostly they never come to light in the media here, and consequently they are able to operate with illegal military action around the world with impunity and in the dark. That is what we are seeing one peak of when we see this particular case.
Right. And Carol, as Don is saying, I mean, you have this top military brass that Don believes that there are the people actually who decide. In this case, in the Afghan case, the top military brass decided that, well, that was a mistake. They apologized, but they're not going to punish any U.S., you know, military member or serviceman for whatever they did. They simply apologized for it. Okay, now, who should hold these top military brass who decide if they've done anything wrong or that was natural and it happens in any war?
Well, the final tribunal is the conscience of the world population. And what's happening with this, if you go back in history, this is completely a degeneration of military warfare, because over the last 20 years, the U.S. has privatized military operations. They want less regular army on the ground, boots on the ground. So they put in these private military corporations, which are mercenaries. So part of the drone strikes and the people operating them has been outsourced to private military companies such as Blackwater and other consorts. Now, we know since the 15th century, Machiavelli warned everybody that soldier fortune, you know, it's the worst thing you can do. So this is completely illegal and opposite to the U.S. Constitution. So we can have international tribunals, but we should especially mobilize the American population to clean up their own country, and because these people should be judged as traitors, including towards the U.S. Constitution, which is completely opposed to what's going on right now.
All right. Don, there was also this investigation by the Times that revealed a top secret American strike cell launched tens of thousands of bombs and missiles against Daesh in Syria, but in the process, the commandos sidestepped safeguards and repeatedly killed civilians. And it's Afghanistan, this is Syria now. And again, where is accountability?
Well, I'll start with the fact that, in fact, the U.S. war in Syria is not a U.S. war against Daesh. It's a U.S. war against Syria. And Daesh, in essence, are the ground troops coordinated with the American airstrikes and other military actions. Before the U.S. decided Assad had to go, there was no Daesh. Daesh is a creature of the CIA and the U.S. military, and on occasion, you get some daylight into that. Like when Trump decided Daesh is the enemy, they were gone in 2 weeks, and suddenly they come back with Biden. I don't know if he drove them there or what. So if we're looking at what's going on in Syria for, you know, for some daylight on this whole thing, what's going on in Syria is U.S. impunity. They've decided they don't like the government there. They're going to change it. They've been working on that now for 10 years. There have been millions of people displaced, hundreds of thousands killed. No one is accountable for that. Again, This is a resolution that was voted down affirmatively in the United Nations Security Council several times. And until Daesh came on the scene, there was no enabling political cause for U.S. military action there. Now, military action has been conducted out in the open, more or less, for almost 10 years.
Right. And Carol, speaking of Daesh or ISIS, we also have these U.S. Drone attacks and targeted killings and extrajudicial killings. The instance of which is the Iranian top commander, General Soleimani, who was at the vanguard of the fight against Daesh in Iraq. He helped the Iraqis get rid of Daesh. He was targeted in a U.S. attack. So we also have these extrajudicial killings. We have condemnation from UN rapporteurs and all that. But on the ground, not much changes. And the U.S. is still going on with these drone attacks. Everywhere in the world they want to target whoever they want to simply take them out.
Yes, the problem is that since the collapse of the Soviet Union in 91, some people got the crazy conviction that the United States, with British backing, was the only remaining superpower in the world, and therefore it can do whatever it likes without being accountable for anything. This is the type of arrogance of power which makes it blind to reality and to its own errors, and it's a symptom of its own doom. And the best people in Russia today dictate to the U.S. that the U.S. should not make the same error as they did when the Soviet system collapsed, you know, which is the idea of impunity and arrogance of power.
Now, Don, as you know, the U.S. does not accord recognition to the International Criminal Court, ICC, nor to the International Court of Justice, ICJ. So which world body should hold Washington accountable for its wrongs?
Well, first I'll add to that, by the way, when they decide that some party's interest in the world could be adjusted in favor of Washington's or the people that the politicians in Washington work for, then suddenly the International Court of Justice and the ICC are, you know, valid international forum to have those things vetted. For example, the Philippines finding in the ICJ regarding South China Sea and the adverse claims in the area around Nicaragua and Colombia. You know, the United States is hot or cold depending on what the outcome is in these in a different each forum. So you have to consider that they really are playing a game of hypocrisy. But to the answer, where do you go for that? Unfortunately, or perhaps fortunately, we'll see how it plays out, the only people that can hold the United States government and the powers that control it, because that's really where the enemy is, are the people of the United States and in solidarity with the people of the world. And the task becomes more and more urgent to deal with this every day as the body count climbs, as the scope of the activities increase, and as the arrogance and impunity of the people that are conducting these wars in the first place finds no limit.
Mm-hmm. Carol, what do you think? If not international tribunals, so who can do what to stop this?
Well, people should escape from their video games and their Netflix addictions. You know, people should become real citizens. And it's only because we are creating real citizens in most countries in the world, and especially in the United States, that we will be able to deal with this issue. This is like a cultural war, you know, to return to a real civilization. It's not just a formal political problem. It's an entire paradigm, which is completely rotten. And if we don't change the paradigm, we will not change the outcome, or the type of events we're seeing right now.
Okay, Don, we have one more minute if you have any final comments.
I completely agree with what he just said, and if you need any evidence of that, look at your children or grandchildren, how much time they spend looking at a device that's telling them what's going on in the world instead of looking at and living in the actual material world.
Right.
And you'll see where the problem and the solution lies.
Okay, thank you very much for your comments. We had a radio host and a journalist, Don Dibar in New York, and from Afghanistan Task Force at the Schiller Institute, Carol break and joined us from the suburbs of Paris. Dubbing your host, Behrouz Najafi, and I'll see you next time.
This is IRIB English Radio. Website is www.parstoday.com/en.
In the limelight.
One thing appears reasonably certain. This new wave, in whatever iteration, will likely exercise the peak of its lethality within the ranks of those who believed Trump's tall tales about rounding the turn, says William Rivers Pitts, journalist, in an article published under the heading, "As more info emerges on Omicron, Trump's old COVID lies continue to kill people." Stay tuned for more. On October 27, 2020, then-President Donald Trump stood before a mostly maskless assemblage of adoring fans and declared the nation was rounding the turn on the COVID-19 pandemic. It was the 40th time he had made this claim in the last 57 days, and it was no more true then than it is now. The average daily infection rate at that time stood around 85,000 new cases per day. Today, over 121,000 cases a day, with a daily death toll back above 1,200. A lot of Trump's people at that time fully believed his negligently homicidal claims about that corner, and many of them still do. Not as many now, of course. Some have come to embrace the science, but tens of thousands of Trump supporters have been killed by this thing, by Trump's flippant dismal of it all. Because of this, there will in all likelihood never be a corner to turn. Endemic is the hot word among COVID epidemiologists these days, which is science speak for pretty much forever. Since May 2021, people living in counties that voted heavily for Donald Trump during the last presidential election have been nearly three times as likely to die from COVID-19, reports NPR. The trend was robust even when controlling for age, which is the primary demographic risk of COVID-19 mortality. The data also reveal a major contributing factor to the death rate difference. The higher the vote share for Trump, the lower the vaccination rate. Now comes the ominously titled Omicron variant, cousin to the Delta variant that is presently spreading all over the US. Omicron has been confirmed in 66 countries all over the world and in 22 US states. COVID experts are laying themselves out trying to answer a number of pressing questions. How transmissible is Omicron? Are the symptoms worse than Delta? Will the vaccines still work? A sobering portrait of the Omicron variant is emerging from the first burst of lab studies on the coronavirus' latest incarnation, showing that the mutated virus can slip past a shield of protection provided by the standard two-shot vaccine regimen, reports the Washington Post. This is but one of the studies that are taking place as yet to be peer-reviewed and rigorously confirmed. There are also suggestions that the symptoms of Omicron could be mild in comparison in those of Delta or the original strain. More than 40 people in the U.S. have been found to be infected with Omicron variant so far, reports the Associated Press, and more than three-quarters of them had been vaccinated. The chief of the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention said recently, but she said nearly all of them were only mildly ill. We can speculate all we wish about the possible need for boosters amid a mild symptom fifth wave of infections, but we won't have solid data about Omicron until all testing has been completed and reviewed. Even then, the variant's long-term effects will remain unknown. One thing appears reasonably certain, however. This new wave, in whatever iteration, will likely exercise the peak of its lethality within the ranks of those who believe Trump's tall tales about rounding the turn. If Trump had a single cure for the people who make him possible, he would embark on a vaccination campaign in all the states he carried in 2020. But he will not do this unless forced to. He will squat in his Bedminster lair plotting revenge, even as those he owes his power to die preventable death every day. It did not have to be this way, but here they are, Perhaps, after another winter of illness, suffering, and doubt, at least some of those who embrace Trump's denial of science will find their way out of that fog.
Good morning.
Our voice comes from the heart of beautiful Iran. IRIB English Radio.
This is IRIB English Radio. Coming up is the news.